This is Israel Rebound, a podcast joining listeners from around the world to Israel, exploring the ties that bind us through culture, identity, and current events. I'm Alan Potash in California, and I'm joined with my co-host and friend Liz Felstern in Jerusalem. Liz, always a pleasure to see you.
You as well.
Thank you. We talked last week about the Eurovision competition and some controversy around Israel's submission, not so much about the performer, but about the songs that they submitted. Do you have any updates on that?
I do. So yes, getting us started with our culture and events. The update is that, as we had sort of intimated was going to happen, the revised lyrics were submitted that no longer make overt reference to October 7th. And this new version was accepted. And so that's what will be performed at the Eurovision in May. And, you know, I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it. On the one hand, it seems sort of unfair that the Israeli representative was denied the ability to talk about something that is so significant and obviously the most pressing issue on the minds of all Israelis at present. But on the other hand, even with the change in lyrics, because it made news that they were being changed, all Israelis will know what the song is really about, right? And I guess now our listeners will as well, even though it's not, you know, blatantly part of the lyrics and the mood of the music as well. I think people will see that it is very much, of course, about October 7th and the current war.
Do you think that this is just another example of how the international world looks at Israel as an outsider, always putting caveats on what and how they show up to things?
I mean, I don't know if I would say that there are always caveats put on how Israel can and cannot show up to things. Certainly in the past 5 months, it's felt like a lot of that. The Eurovision has, in some ways, it's always been kind of an outlier. Like, even though there's been a lot of sentiment in Europe that was anti-Israel, the Eurovision was sort of a safe space for us for some reason. Like, not only has Israel been there every year, but we won multiple times. And so it's sad, I guess, that now it seems like less of a safe space. But also, I think it is really important that we be there. And so it was worth, right, having to curb a little bit what we might have liked the lyrics to be, and rather than give up what is literally, right, in an internationally visible stage, I think it's important for Israel to be there, and I think it's important for Israelis to be there and be seen.
I think we've talked about the Eurovision quite a bit during the history of our podcast, which is going on 3 years. If the and we have the downloads to prove it. But I want to just jump a second. Several years ago, Israel won the Eurovision contest. And when you win the contest, you are the host the next year. Is that correct?
Yes, that is how it works.
And it was very impressive, I think. Also, several years ago, Israel hosted, was it the Miss Universe competition? There's always something that Israel's hosting.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now that you mention it, I do remember talking about that. I think it was down in Eilat.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. So what's interesting to me is, you know, here is Israel making all sorts of changes in order to be welcomed and represented in these national, international festivals, and also with the idea that at some point, if they win, they have to host it in Israel. And I'm just hoping that if this contestant wins the Eurovision, that people will come to Israel and see how wonderful the country is.
That would be lovely. I had not honestly thought that far ahead of what happens if Israel wins, and will that be yet another issue? Will a year from this May, the international community be willing to come to Israel? Who knows?
Well, I always try to be optimistic and look to the future. So there you go.
It's true. We should all be assuming that Eyal Golan is, or whatever her name is. Is that her name? Not Eyal Golan. Eden Golan. Eyal Golan is another singer. That she's going to win. And yes, we should all be thinking that way. Good for you.
So let's shift from culture, which we always like to talk about, besides food. I understand that the Jerusalem Marathon took place yesterday. What was that like? Were there a lot of people there? Were there any people from around the world that participated? What's your take on the festival, on the marathon?
Yeah, so the marathon took place on Friday. Apparently had a record number of runners with 40,000 runners, which did include international runners, about 1,800 international runners. And, you know, it's sort of a funny thing to decide whether it's appropriate to have something like a marathon, which is usually a pretty happy, celebratory athletic event, in the midst of a war. And there were a lot of different things that were done to try and bridge that gap and make it appropriate and what it needed to be for now. So, for example, there were families of hostages and released hostages who took part in the opening ceremonies and the opening speeches. A DJ who had played at the Nova Festival and survived did some of the DJing at the marathon. There were lots of groups who ran right in memory of or in honor of people impacted on October 7th and by the ensuing war. So there were all of those elements. And overall, I think it was, you know, for what it can be, a very positive marathon. The weather was perfect for runners. It was quite cool, but not rainy or anything. And yeah, it happened. We did it.
And no issues, I take it.
No, I didn't hear about any security issues or anything like that. No. I mean, the security for the marathon has always been pretty serious. It's like shuts down the entire city. If anybody ever has a chance to be in Jerusalem during the marathon, I'm not 100% sure that I would recommend it, because, I mean, a huge percentage of the streets are literally just shut down for the whole day. And there are even places where on foot you can't cross streets at certain times because it's only for the runners. So there have been years where I've tried to, it's always on a Friday, and there have been years where I've tried to go out and do like my Friday morning pre-Shabbat shopping and found that that was impossible. So this year I thought in advance and figured out, okay, I'm only going to plan to do my shopping by foot and in a route that does not involve crossing any major arteries, so that I knew I wouldn't have an issue. And that worked out well, but, it's a big deal for the city.
So your strategy of shopping on for Shabbat is similar to a runner trying to navigate the course of 26 miles.
Oh, luckily I didn't have to go quite that far.
Well, I always think that a marathon is a great way to inspire and to bring people together. So thank you for sharing that.
Sure. Can I move us to another topic?
I'm the one who likes to ask the questions, though.
I know. That's why I was like, I'm gonna ask permission. So sort of stepping a little bit away from the more lighthearted cultural events, one topic that you and I have been coming back to sort of again and again over the past few months is anti-Semitism. And we've been following some writers and some thinkers on this topic, particularly in the United States, and what people are seeing and how people are responding. And I think that in the past week, there's been some additional articles and thinkers on this topic that it might be worth highlighting. Are there any writings that you've seen that you want to share with our listeners?
But, well, you know, this is one of my favorite topics of sharing what I have, what I read throughout the week. I will share with you that there was a really interesting article that just came out the other day by Franklin Foer, who writes for The Atlantic, and he came out with a very intensive, long, and thoughtful article called "The Golden Age of American Jews is Ending." And I'll put a link to it into our podcast. I have to just recommend people, you have to be a member or subscriber to The Atlantic in order to read it. But it is a very, very in-depth analysis of how he has viewed the increase of anti-Semitism and where it comes from, and then puts it into an article that kind of breaks it down really, really well. There is another podcast that he is on. He's not on our podcast, but if you don't want to read the article, he is being interviewed by Al Franken on Al Franken's podcast. But for me, it's an example of how American Jews are looking at the war in Israel, the support for Israel, and the anti-Semitism that we've started to see really balloon since October the 7th. We've talked about several other articles and other events. I mentioned a couple weeks ago that I happened to go to the Rancho Mirage Writers Festival to hear Barry Wise and Brett Stevens talk about how to fight anti-Semitism. And then I've been finding stuff online that I just find to be incredibly helpful to understand where people are thinking and how they're thinking and how they're coming to their understanding of supporting Israel and at the same time being challenged for that as American academic institutions. And even what Franklin Foer talks about is high schools, middle schools, and even elementary schools, how teachers are addressing this and breaking it down into very simplistic ways as the oppressors and the oppressed, and putting Jews and Israel into the oppressor category and everybody else in the oppressed. So it's very uncomfortable to hear and to read about the anti-Semitism and how the left and the right have played a role over the years in I would say, evolving it. And Franklin Foer does a really good job of going back through the history, as have other people who've written pieces. There's another piece that came out that I didn't talk about last week by Noah Feldman on anti-Semitism. It was in Time magazine, and that's also worth reading. So for me, here we are in America, and I kind of talked about this with you before, that from the outside, looking at Israel, how are we absorbing what's been going on since October the 7th? And are these messages getting communicated to Israel, and are Israelis following the anti-Semitism that is taking place in America and in England and in other parts of the world?
I think that for Israelis, the elements of anti-Semitism that catch our attention are the ones that tend to be more violent in nature, right? So when there are mass protests and demonstrations and things like that against Israel, that does make news in Israel, and Israelis are paying attention. But something like the question of whether a golden age for Jews has passed in the United States is less on the Israeli radar. The whole concept is foreign, right? What does it look like? How would one know if one was in a golden age in the diaspora for Jews, right? The whole concept is very foreign to Israelis, so it's less on our radar. I think it's a fascinating question because I guess conceptually, right, one never knows one's in a golden age until it's over. And so that question of, is that what has happened? Or maybe we haven't even gotten to the golden age of Jewish life in America yet. I think that's really an interesting question.
I think he looks at it from the perspective of how American Jewish life has grown and how, for the most part, we have felt accepted in society, and being able to look at how over just the past 5 months, and he's really saying it's longer than the 5 months, that it goes back to even the early 2000s, that when the world looks for scapegoats, there's a natural scapegoat, and that's the Jews. And so we've always been kind of on the outside, but we have felt accepted, you know, over the years. You know, if you look at just the success of American writers and performers, artists, you know, they're very, very much successful. You know, you look at Seinfeld and the success of his show, and you look at other writers and you look at musicians. You know, there's been a lot of success in American Jewish contributions to America.
And no, for sure. I do think that there's always been that tension of that Jews can be very much accepted as long as they're not all that Jewish, right? The Jews that have tended to do very well, the fact that they are in some sense defined as Jewish is about where their Jewishness has ended. And so, yeah, like what kind of acceptance is that? It's an acceptance, but with strings attached, or how, where are the boundaries? I think those have always been questions. But yeah, I think people should read the article and see what they think about whether that trajectory shifted over the past 20 years. And are we in fact headed to something else? Or might we read the history differently?
Well, if it is true, how do we shift it? And to your point, you never know until it's over with if we've been in a golden age. But I think that we as an American Jewish community need to look at what do we need to do to continue to strengthen our image in America. Mm-hmm. And I would say personally that Israel's success in the Six-Day War gave many Jews the comfort and power of knowing that we are no longer the victim in being bullied or harassed, that we now have a strong presence in Israel to protect, defend, and accept us.
Yeah. And might victory, whatever that winds up looking like in this current war, have a very different feeling because it is coming with all of the baggage of the world looking at us, as you said, right, as the oppressor. It doesn't have the same feel of the Six-Day War. So what that will mean for the collective Jewish American psyche is yet to be seen.
Right. But again, going back to that, the double standard of why Israel is singled out when people aren't looking at what goes on in Sudan or in Syria or in China or in India and other places, but it's easy to target Israel because historically the Jews have been that target.
Right. Look, that is a phenomenon that I don't know how anybody explains, right? Why the Jews? Why is everybody so interested, looking so closely under such a microscope when, yeah, as you said, there are many other examples of horrific things happening around the world every day that the media doesn't seem to think are even worth, you know, putting any attention on.
So before I ask you a question about our next topic, I want our listeners to know that if you're interested in learning more about anti-Semitism from that perspective, that Rabbi David Wolpe did a talk on the 23 centuries of anti-Semitism, 23 centuries of anti-Semitism, and that's at the Stryker Center in New York, and that you can find that recording online. And again, I'll put a link to the Stryker Center in our notes. Talking about anti-Semitism, Liz, Purim is coming up in a couple of weeks. I've used Purim as my starting point to talk about anti-Semitism because really that's what Haman's goal was to eliminate the Jewish community. How's Purim looking this year?
Well, even though we are 2 weeks out, the pre-Purim festivities are definitely already happening. If you don't have school-aged kids in Israel, you might not be feeling it as acutely. But for those of us who do, Purim apparently is like a 2-week holiday, and every day is something different. So we're very busy with whether it's pajama day or wear a certain color to school day or wear a funky hat day or dancing day, or there's one day for dressing up as a character from the Megillah, which I thought was pretty interesting because it used to be that that was what people often wore for their costume on Purim itself. But I guess that has gone so far out of fashion that they were able to name a separate day for dressing up as a character from the Megillah, which is very different than your actual Purim costume on Purim. So we have all of these many things going on, and the kids are all hyped up on all kinds of sweets and treats. So buckle up, parents of Israel.
Is it ironic that Purim, in my mind, connects us to the history of anti-Semitism, but yet today in 2024 or 5784, Jews are embracing Purim in Jerusalem and in other parts of Israel? And I think that's a celebratory comment.
Look, because Purim is about a failed attempt at genocide against the Jews, it has always been a pretty celebratory holiday, right? I mean, it's about survival. It's about success. But yeah, there are dark parts of the story, and how they will land this year in particular is, I don't know how that story will sound to hear it this year. I guess we have to get a little bit closer and see how that feels, but it's not lost on us that it's a real, you know, type of story. I mean, the things that happen in the Megillah are not so different than things that happen today.
I will leave you on that note, but I have a favor to ask of you. We haven't talked about food in a long time, and Purim typically has a pastry, the humantashen. What else is there for feeding the belly of the soul with food during Purim?
There's just way too much junk food. But I will tell you about two interesting foods, Purim foods, that I saw just in the past couple of days. So one I saw, this is not a traditional Purim food, but a bakery chain was selling heart-shaped cookies as a fundraiser for female lone soldiers in Israel. And the heart cookies, they were saying that this is the heart of Esther. This is the heart of Esther, of a warrior that fights for the state of Israel and beats in the heart of every Israeli female soldier. And so that was the cookie that they had created for this fundraiser. So I thought that was really interesting. And a second thing that I saw, a Moroccan Purim food that I was not familiar with, is a bread, like a little roll, with a hard-boiled egg inside of it, sort of peeking out of the top. You can see the hard-boiled egg coming out of the roll. And I guess you serve these, and it's supposed to be Haman's eyes. And then you take out the egg, sort of, I guess, gouging out his eyes in retribution. But the photograph looked very lovely of this bread. The description made it a little less appealing to want to eat it, but it looked cool. So if people are interested in broadening their Purim baking repertoire, they can look up the Moroccan Haman's Eyes rolls.
Well, that's what we look to you for, is to bring us unique cultural adaptations for the holidays.
I try. I really try.
So with that, anything else you want to add, Liz?
Just that everybody should enjoy the festivities. You know, sometimes while it feels like a bit of a, I don't know, juxtaposition with what's going on in the world, I think for all of our mental health and well-being, we do need to find those moments to celebrate. So I hope that people do find ways to do that for Purim.
And I think that's true also for events like the Jerusalem Marathon and Eurovision, that finding ways to relate back to what society is about versus just constantly dealing with the trauma that Israel has been experiencing since October the 7th. So with that, thank you. And thank you all for listening. This has been Israel Rebound, a podcast bringing interesting things to you from around the world. Well, mostly from Israel, but to around the world. Thank you all for listening.
Thanks, Alan. Thanks, everyone.